Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, merchandise, an archive of past episodes and information on how you can help keep this podcast running. That's fyrgen.com. Hello friends and welcome to the Fergan once again. This episode I have a very special guest by the name of Alfric Avery. Alfric is an author and musician who I've been very keen to speak to for quite some time. He was actually recommended by Thorbecht Hlaford of episode number 27, who is the König of the Winland Ríki, which is the overarching Thaedish group of America. And Alfric Avery is a Thaedsman. He is the leader of the Hraunshir Thaed in British Columbia, Canada. His music is of an ancient Germanic sort, and his album Mimir's Mead is one that I've been particularly fond of for many years. And having had the opportunity now to listen to most of his works and absorb them, I am very keen to speak to Alfric about the way that he approaches music, as well as his writings. So, Alfric, it's great to be speaking with you, and how are you?
I'm very well, and I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Alfric is all the way over in British Columbia, so we're quite far apart. So if there's any signs of lag in audio here or any technical problems, then I'll do my best to edit them out, but bear with us and we'll do our best to present a coherent conversation here. So, Alfric, what is your background then? You're known as an author, and the books that you are probably best known for that I know of are The Elder Trow, Volume 1, which is a book on Germanic heathen social structure. But you're also very well known for, and I think that could rightly be called a Thaedish book, really. Whereas you've also written some books on the Black Sun and the Armanan runes. So which was your first book and when did you start authoring books?
My first book was Gott's Descendants, which I published in 2016. But that book, the bulk of it was actually written a number of years previous when I was in the early days of my Theodish experience.
Right, okay. And so you were a musician before you were an author then?
That's correct. I started doing heathen music in 96, also in a Theodish context. That was around the time that I started getting involved with Theodism.
Right. Was that your first release? Correct me if I'm wrong here, but was it Harp Runes from All Father's Hall?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. It's I've had the pleasure of immersing myself in Alfric's music recently. And what I particularly like about your releases is that each of them does have its own unique atmosphere to it. All of them are very ancient and authentic sounding. And in them, you explore the various ancient Germanic tongues. Right. Did that begin with Harp Runes from All Father's Hall? Were there multiple languages on that one?
Harp Runes is just Anglo-Saxon. That was my first elder tongue that I used. And then shortly after that, I started branching out and using others. Like there's some old Frisian on Songs of the Elder Trow, which came after Harp Runes. And then I also used Gothic. That was for Songs of the Ancient Goths, which I recorded in 2002. So I was, at the time, I was branching out into different Germanic languages, experimenting with them and exploring different tribal interests and possibilities of reconstruction of different Germanic tribal musics other than the Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning at this point that you do have a particular interest in ancient Gothic heathenry, and you've written several books on that. What is it that led you to that interest?
Actually, it was a very personal experience that I had. I can't really say that it was any specific external event. It was a moment where I felt that almost as if there was some sort of ancient fetch that was trying to get my attention, call my attention to the Goths. And the experience hit me so strongly that it just became an interest that I pursued after a certain point. It felt like there was something that was trying to come through, trying to enlist me to help it express itself somehow.
Well, I'm glad that happened because the Gothic heathens, I think, is a relatively untapped or unexplored region of ancient heathenry. So I imagine that although I confess that I've not read any of the books, I imagine that your books on that subject are of particular value to people who are looking to learn more about Gothic heathenry. And when you pair those books with the music that you've written and sung in the ancient Gothic language, it really does bring, it does seem to bring ancient Gothic heathenry to life. So if there's anyone out there who is, more of a continental Germanic in terms of their ancestry, I think these books and this music will be of particular interest to you. But Alfric, I mean, the Winland Rite and Theodish belief tends to focus more on the Anglo-Saxon heathen experience. So is that your primary focus, the Anglo-Saxon as opposed to the Gothic?
The Anglo-Saxon is my primary focus. That's correct. And Hravenshire is an Anglo-Saxon Theod, so we are practicing Anglo-Saxon heathenry. But in terms of Theodism, it wasn't always the case that Anglo-Saxon was the entire focus. It certainly started out that way. But in the 90s, there was a period where Theodism was experimenting with different tribal groups. So that was the context in which my interest in the reconstruction of Gothic heathenry arose. It was a sort of a contribution to that line of thinking in Theodism. However, since then, Theodism has gone more in the direction of being just Anglo-Saxon, I would say.
And would you say that do you bring any aspects of Gothic heathenry into your practice, or do you try to keep it, so to speak, pure Anglo-Saxon?
Well, that's a good question, and it's actually been different over time. There were times where, in the old days, where I would do feignings entirely in Gothic, which is certainly possible with the amount of material that we've reconstructed. And then there were also times where I would mix Gothic and Anglo-Saxon and sometimes Old Norse. These were sort of experiments that I was doing, mostly because I had Galdurs that I had written in these different languages that I wished to use all in the same feigning. But also at the same time, I noted that there was an incongruity between the languages by mixing languages like that. And then I also listened to the feedback of the other people who were attending the feignings. And one of the things that I heard was that, yes, there is an incongruity here. And it turned out that it was preferred when I would simply do a feigning in Anglo-Saxon in one language, right? Because there's different... They sound different. There's different orthographies for people who are reading along. So to switch to one from one to the other can be jarring. And so these days I find it easier and more appealing to the people attending our feignings to just use Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. I'm wondering, aside from the linguistic aspect of it, are there any attested practices or aspects of ritual which are perhaps mentioned in the Gothic sources which aren't mentioned in the Anglo-Saxon ones that you've maybe you know brought in and then maybe used the Old English language to actually perform those rituals? Is there anything like that?
There are a number of ritual practices of the ancient Goths that are attested, but it's usually things like making a sacrifice to a holy image or a whale that's being carried around in a wagon, things that are familiar from other areas of Germanic heathenry. Some of those things, of course, are difficult to incorporate into a regular feigning practice, but I would say that there is some influence, but perhaps it's more of a modern development. So in the early 2000s, I was developing some fire ritual practices, which I was doing at the time primarily with Gothic in the context of Gothic language and culture. And those practices caught the interest of the Anglo-Saxon heathens in Thaidism as well. And so I ended up translating those Gothic Galdurs into Anglo-Saxon, and they've gotten some use and had some influence in Anglo-Saxon Thaidish ritual as well, including our ritual today. I still use those Galdurs when I'm lighting the sacred fire, for example, and other Thaidsmen these days do as well.
All right. Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a really good example of how that little bit of, you know, dare I call it cross-contamination, can actually enrich the Germanic heathen experience. But I mean, Alfric and I, we have lots of topics to get into, and you know, concerning heathenry, obviously. But I really wanted to spend some time talking about music, particularly as Alfric's music was my first port of call in encountering his work. So as mentioned, he has a number of albums which he's made, most of them being harp music. So they're very traditional sounding, very, very ancient Germanic sounding, sung in a variety of ancient Germanic tongues, whether it be Gothic, Old English, Frisian, Old Norse. And so how do you go about approaching this music? I mean, obviously your goal is to resurrect something very ancient and authentic sounding, right? Is that what you set out to do?
It is. And the main purpose of my music, or the reason why I'm trying to do this, is because I've wanted the Galdurs to use in ritual, mostly for my own purposes. Others have found them interesting and useful as well, which is great. But my real motivation is just to get the material, you know, to use in our own worship.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I think that's probably the most noble reason you could have given for being a musician. You know, others will talk about fame and fortune or, you know, having a widely distributed record, but you're literally just creating music for your own ritual practices. Nevertheless, I mean, it's become quite well-respected music worldwide among heathens who have discovered your music. And Mimir's Mead particularly is an album which I listen to regularly, and the other albums as well are albums that will probably be with me for life, because you know, Alfric and I had a brief kind of warm-up discussion before this, and I mentioned how even black metal to me has quite a spiritual undercurrent to it. And I've talked about that in my episode Pagan Music, in which I actually did feature one of your songs, Alfric, as well. But your music has that same power, that same ability to transform the listener to another time and place, to take them out of the current and put them somewhere timeless. And those who know of my music under the name Walkensman may know that in interviews I've talked about trying to do the very same thing. And although my music isn't intended to sound authentically ancient, it is meant to sound somewhat timeless. Alfric's music, I would say, sounds even more timeless because is from an ancient time, yet feels relevant and feels potent and virile still today. So is the atmosphere that you imbue in the music, is that an important aspect of it?
Well, the atmosphere is my sense of mystery of this, or I feel like in my music I'm trying to reach back to some great age, some long lost forgotten time, which is really what we're doing in modern heathenry, what we're trying to do. And it's sort of my own artistic sense of how that might be represented in sound, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That
it would make sense to you, because I hear the same thing in your music. I love Walkensman. It's your music is fantastic and has, you know, even though you're it's more of a hybrid in terms of instrumentation and style, it still has a very ancient, authentic feel. It still reaches back into those deep roots to capture something, and that's what makes it very appealing to a heathen.
Oh, thank you very much, Alfric. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, that was definitely my intention. And although I don't want this discussion to really be too much about me, when I my kind of foray into heathenry was discovering it was actually, and I've talked about this before and I'm not ashamed to admit it, but it was when I read books like Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock, and what came to me was the idea that our ancestors were probably far wiser and more capable of building grandiosity than we are today, and understood the natural world and the mysteries of the cosmos in a better way than we do today. So when I came to composing music, I wanted the music to be as mystical, as grand, as inspiring, as you know, as spiritual as I felt that those ancient temples that must have been built, and the setups that were where the gods were worshipped in the groves, these experiences, you know, and the film Excalibur from the 80s, I think actually depicts, although not an overtly pagan film, it does depict that kind of, you know, that kind of very noble and grandiose ceremony that took place in the ancient world. And I wanted to create music that was befitting of those kind of scenes. And your music, Alfric, takes me to those same kinds of places. And I think really that's what both of us are striving for, is this idea that if we are going to be practicing heathens, we need music that transforms us in the same way that the rituals themselves, the dress perhaps that we wear, myths of the gods that we evoke in those times, we want the same kind of wonder from the music that accompanies those things, right?
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better myself. And that wonder is an inspiration to us as artists. It comes from our inspiration, and it is also inspiring to us. But it's an inspiration that we can share with other heathens and other people in general, in hopes of inspiring them in the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, inspiring is the word. Everything, I think. In some ways, you could say that that is the word that kind of underlines all of heathen practices, that everything you do needs to inspire in some way. The way that you set up the rites, the way that you present yourself, the words that you use, the music that accompanies it, all of it needs to inspire. So how do you, may I ask, how do you approach, you know, your compositions are For the most part, original. I have heard in some of your songs some traditional. There's one song of yours on Mimir's Mead which uses a traditional Norwegian folk melody, I believe. So some of your songs, I know you do borrow from traditional melodies, but most of it is your own composition, right?
Many of the songs on my albums are my own compositions, but I have also used quite a few ancient texts. So. For example, in Old English, there are a number of poems that have survived that are perfectly suitable for setting to music and using in a heathen context today. It's a mix, but I have done a lot of composition as well. And I would say that doing the kind of music that I do is probably somewhat more complicated than your average artist would have to deal with in their compositions, and that is because I'm using ancient languages and poetic form. So it's not as simple as just, you know, rattling off some lyrics and writing them down. You know, obviously none of these ancient languages are my first language, so there's that barrier, which means that you have to have a bit of scholarship at your fingertips. There's some learning involved, and I will be referring to grammars and dictionaries, so you know, which you have to do to get your forms correct. And so there's in that sense, the initial stage of the composition is perhaps a little bit more scholarly or on the intellectual side than your average artist would be dealing with. But at the same time, you are trying to capture the inspiration of the thing that you're trying to compose. So it's sort of like using both parts of the brain at the same time. You have to be very, very intellectual and very creative somehow at the same time. And I've spent years sort of working with this system of balancing these two things to try to come to a system that I'm comfortable with, which I have done. I feel comfortable composing in Old English and other languages now, but I would say that it took some time to really develop that, because it isn't the easiest thing in the world to do.
Yeah, I very, very much know the feeling of trying to balance that kind of left brain and right brain when composing music, because you have this especially when you're you know, trying to mix a whole heap of instruments together. You have this very kind of mathematical approach to it, and you say, right, okay, so for the first half of that verse, it's going to be just those instruments. And then, you know, from bars 4 to 8, this instrument is going to come in. And then when it comes to the second verse, all of it's going to be there, but there's going to be this harmony, and you kind of construct it in this very methodical way. But you also need to allow for that right brain, pure kind of creative element to come in the first place, so that the melodies that you create are at least attempting to be profound in some way, rather than, you know, because you can almost imagine AI music these days trying to compose that kind of music, and it would find the right musical scale, then it would find a sequence of notes within that scale that sounds somewhat coherent, and then that would be the melody. But you want to try and create something far more divine than that, and the only way to do that is to kind of let go of that left-brained aspect of yourself, at least momentarily, so that you can come up with something at least approaching profound. So it sounds like you have a very similar kind of struggle that I do when composing.
Yeah, you have to know when to let the one side go and focus on the other, mm-hmm. and then it's a constant juggling between the two. during the composition process.
Yeah. So do you start with the melody first or the words first? I'm guessing probably the words, because the words are so important, so intrinsic to what you're trying to achieve.
Essentially, it would be starting with the words, yes. But at the same time, the melody is a whole other aspect. So there's hardly anything surviving of ancient heathen music. Right. Mm. What was written down was in that time was church music, and there's even very little surviving of that. There's certainly folk songs that have survived. My goal has been to try to make a thick sounding music, but with so little surviving that is difficult. And we can certainly take elements of traditional folk music that are probably ancient or that we know trace back to a certain number of centuries ago, and we can work with that stylistically to use those melodies, which I've done sometimes, used some ancient melodies. But what I find myself resorting to rather is inspiration, because there's so little surviving of ancient music. I try to keep the general idea of the stylistic elements of what we know of ancient music in mind. And then other than that, I have to say, I really don't make any effort to compose the music. It composes itself. Mm-hmm. It's all melodies that I hear, you know, when I'm in the shower or something pops into my head in a dream that I happen to remember when I woke up, or the wind will be blowing a certain way, and, you know, for a number of weeks, and it will, you know, sort of bang out a tune on the wind chimes, and that gets stuck in my head, or, you know, something like that. And so, yeah, there's no effort put into actually composing melodies. And then I record these melodies just in a rough form, so that when I have a composition, a written composition, then I can cycle through my store of inspired melodies to find one that fits. Because mm-hmm. what I find is it won't be just any melody that fits with any lyrics. Some of them will not work at all together. But then you find one and it's perfect. It's just a perfect match. And then that's the one I go with for that song.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It does at times seem like the music is coming through you rather than from you. And I think you've kind of portrayed that well there, where you talked about that almost superstitious way of hearing music and, you know, in the wind or coming through in dreams and things. And I have had similar experiences myself. And I always say, when people ask me how I compose music, I always say, you know, 95% of it is in my head while I'm out walking somewhere. You know, you don't compose, well, I can't really compose songs by just sitting on a seat with a guitar and going, right, I'm going to write a song now. It doesn't work like that. You know, the melody will come to you usually at times when you least expect it, or certainly at times when you're not forcing it. So yeah, I think we have got a similar approach there to our composition. And also, I mean, you use, most of your music is using the ancient Germanic harp. And I guess I don't have any experience playing the lyre or the harp myself, so I can't really speak with any authority on it. But I do, as I understand it, you are limited to the notes that you can use based on the strings that are on the harp. So I suppose in a way that kind of defines the boundaries for what you can compose musically, right?
It does, but there's a couple interesting points about that. At first, I remember being or finding it daunting to only have six strings to compose with, right? Previously, I had played guitar and piano and other instruments, so I was used to having a lot more notes at my disposal. But what I found is that when you limit the number of notes, the number of strings, it forces you to become more creative, to work with what you have. So that was an interesting point. I found myself doing things with six strings that I would have never thought to do on a guitar. And then the other thing is that with those six strings, there are certain tendencies towards chords that you can form. So you will end up using certain chords more than others, and then that ends up giving the music a distinct style. And then we can only hope that because we're using the same type of instrument with the same limitations, the things that we're coming up with on the instrument that are distinctive may have been something like what the ancient players of the harp or lyre would have come up with as well.
Right. Yeah, there were only so many combinations.
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to hear about the way that you go about approaching recreating this ancient Germanic music. And yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to going back through your music and bearing, you know, those ideas in mind. So to move on, we were going to discuss a little bit about the power and importance of the shop or the skald, the storyteller, and, you know, musically, that would be referred to as the gleeman, you know, the storyteller who does so in a poetic or musical form. In the podcast episode with Thorbecht, which I do believe was number 27, Theodish Belief, Thorbecht made a very profound point, I think, which stuck with me, which is this idea that one of the reasons for the problems that we have today in our modern world is that we've kind of lost control of our own stories. Our stories have become corrupted or perverted or lost to us in some way. And I made a post on my Telegram channel recently about how the shop or the storyteller, was their role was to almost to shape reality through the stories that they told. And a bandmate of mine mentioned recently, who's done a lot of research into ancient mythology, and he made the point that, or he drew to my attention the fact that the ancient Celts are kind of known to have made up a lot of stories. A lot of their stories actually turn out to be factually untrue, but that almost doesn't matter when we consider that those stories were true for them. They formed the narrative for those tribes, and those tribes moved ahead and interacted with one another accordingly. So how do you feel about that? I know that you write music for a ritual purpose, but do you also feel any kind of responsibility for the way that you're creating stories and that you're inviting people into a world that you've created through your music?
Absolutely. That's a very important point. And I agree that Thorbecht made that point about narratives. Very clearly, I couldn't state it as well as he did. But yes, there is a responsibility. The shop has a responsibility for creating other narratives. Perhaps we could consider them to be better or healthier or more helpful narratives. And you're also right when you say that it's not about historical accuracy. Shopcraft is not what we would consider modern academic history. It's not about taking things literally and getting the fine little historical details all accurate. It's about something greater than that. It's about poetic significance. It's about a truth that is greater than a historical truth, something that is timeless, something that transcends the mundane little nitpicky details of a fully accurate history. So a shop or bard or ancient composer of ancient stories would be less concerned with little details like that and more concerned with conveying some greater meaning using examples of legendary figures, heroes, and kings or gods doing things in a way that conveys a deeper, more timeless message rather than something to be taken literally. It's difficult for us in modern times because in a post-Christian world, we have all been exposed to this idea that the Bible needs to be taken literally and everything about spirituality and religion is something that we should be looking at in a literal sense. And even the Bible wasn't intended, or it can be argued that the Bible was never intended to be taken literally, but that certainly is the case in a heathen context. there's no value in trying to, you know, pin down, you know, a time and a place, or, you know, some exact little historical description for some heroic characters or something like that, because it would be missing the point. The point is that this is conveying some concept that is essential to the worldview of the tribe, or some greater spiritual truth that is the characters in the story are being used to convey.
Yeah, one of the kind of fundamental aspects of heathen belief is that goodness is what's good for the tribe. So in that context, it almost doesn't matter whether your shop is lying in the stories that they create. All that matters is that it benefits the tribe in some way. And I think it was, I can't remember who said it. It may have been Joseph Campbell, someone like that, who said that myth really is just eternal, eternal truth, or something, words to that effect. So there really is little point in talking about an objective history, really, because every different group of people is going to have their own spin on events that occur. And really, all that should matter is the impact that the narrative has on your own folk, because the reality is that we aren't a universal species of people with a single universal truth. We are a collection of different folks who have truths which matter to them.
That's right. Yeah. So the real question is, what does that story teach you about your folk, about your identity, about who you are, about what the values of your people are, about what your thew should be, what is acceptable within your tribal society? What are the greater understandings that are being passed on from generations of wise men who have accumulated wisdom, passed it on, and through the generations for the benefit of the folk? These are the things that I think that we should really be looking at and looking for when we look at either ancient stories or when we think about composing stories in modern times.
Yeah. I mean, I've always had difficulty with the idea of writing lyrics which are, you know, just based on some kind of failed relationship or an event that happened to me yesterday. You know, these kind of very... I don't know, kind of changeable moments that happen within our lives, these fairly insignificant moments, which some lyricists do make songs from. They will write a song about, you know, the club that they went to last night, or the girlfriend they had last week, or, the holiday that they had. And to me, those have always seemed very, very kind of empty, very superficial. And I've always sought to try and write lyrics which are grander in scope and more timeless in scope, and can be identified not just in a way that everyone can identify with the stories in those lyrics, but that people of all times, that I like the idea that in 300 years time, if someone happens to find a CD, you know, lying in the dirt somewhere and finds a way to play it, that the lyrics will speak to them still.
Yeah, I think that what you're talking about is that in modern times, there's a general lack of a sense of significance or a sense of what is holy. In a post-Christian society, an atheistic society, where science is often the only real religion, we live in a world that has been demystified. Yeah. So nothing is sacred anymore. And then if that's the case, if that's what you believe, then you might as well write a song about the club you were at last week, because one thing doesn't necessarily have any more meaning or significance than another. And this is the idea, I think, that we're trying to combat to a large extent. In heathenry, we're trying to say that the world and things in the world and things beyond the world do have significance. Things do have meaning. In fact, things with meaning and significance are the only things that really have meaning, or the only things that are really worth pursuing or doing anything about. If something doesn't have significance, it isn't really worth our time. So we're trying to bring back this idea of significance, this idea of what is holy and holiness in general.
Yeah, well, thank you for that insight. Yeah, I very much agree. So moving on from music and the idea of shopcraft and things like that, and narratives and stories, you are also obviously a well-known author, as we mentioned at the beginning of the conversation. well known in heathen circles for your books on Theurdish belief, such as the Elder Trow, and your books on the Goths, of course. But you, one thing that we discussed, you and I, in our warm up to this was how we might tackle the topic of these kind of seemingly contradicting schools of heathen thought. You have the, obviously, you are a Theurdish Hlaford of your Theod. You are part of the Winland Ríche. You are a Theurdish heathen. But you've also written books on some decidedly non-Theurdish topics involving the Armanan runes. So you mentioned that you'd be interested in discussing how we might reconcile these things and your attitude and what's led you to have these kind of two sides to your heathen output.
I think that modern heathenry in general has a tendency to focus on the external aspects of religion, the religious aspects, the communal aspects of worship. So we're looking at external gods, the worship of external gods, right? We're not talking about something inside ourselves per se. Maybe some people will be interpreting the gods that way, but in general, mm-hmm. we're looking at something sort of exoteric in modern heathenry in general. And that's great. That's an essential part of recovering the ancient heathenry, the collective worship of the gods by the folk. That's what heathenry is, right? But what I've noticed is that there is more to it than that, right? There is the personal element, the individual element, the personal spiritual element, and we don't talk about that a lot in modern heathenry. Heathens might be more inclined to criticize that about Christians. They talk about how Christians are focused on individual salvation, right? And then contrast heathens to that by saying, well, we're focused on the collective, the group worship and relationship to the gods. But I don't think that it's as simple as that. I think that both elements are necessary. And I don't believe that contrast between those two is necessarily valid. Even from the Christian side, yes, Christians are focused on individual salvation, but the church group, the collective, has always been a major focus of Christianity. And in heathenry, also, I believe that the individual spiritual focus has a place. It has a role to play, because if you have communities that are made up of individuals, and those individuals are not pursuing anything for their own personal development and betterment, for their own spiritual advancement, for their own ability to grow. And when I say to grow, I mean more than just being able to make the right noises and contribute to the group in the way that the group sees fit. I'm talking about an inner transformation that makes you a better person, that helps you overcome your demons, right? If this isn't happening on an individual level, then you're going to have communities that are made up of unhealthy individuals. And then if that was the case, would we have any reason to be surprised if we had unhealthy communities? We don't want unhealthy communities. So to do that, we have to address the individual spiritual level as well, at least in my opinion. If you were to say, well, we're going to focus either on the group religious experience or the individual spiritual experience, to me, that would be kind of like getting up in the morning and asking yourself whether you want to put on your shirt or your pants. Because the answer is really that you need them both, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially here in Britain, where pants are underwear.
Yes, in that case, certainly.
Yeah, definitely important. No, I couldn't agree more with you there. And it's, you know, I've heard this referred to as the inner circle and the outer circle, and both are important. And the inner circle, the more esoteric circle, feeds the outer circle, the outer circle kind of bolsters and protects the inner circle. So there is this mutually beneficial relationship between the two. It's kind of like a healthy dualism that we have within heathenry. I think that my experience with Germanic heathenry is that most groups who moot, who practice, who blot together, they have that communal aspect that you talk about down to a T. They're very, very good at that. They have that, you know, gathering in a circle around a fire at particular times of the year, you know, the very, you know, ceremonial honoring of the high holy tides, saying the right words. But when it comes to anything that is a bit more esoteric or demands a bit more kind of action from the individual in a kind of lone wolf capacity, there isn't so much of that. And when I first became interested in paganism, I was actually exploring the Celtic side of paganism, because I'd come from, again, I'll mention, you know, I'd read the books of Graham Hancock, and he wrote a book called Supernatural, which I read when it came out. That was really my first introduction to the world of, this idea of a spirit world. And that was also my introduction to shamanism. So I thought, well, okay, well, there is this shamanic tradition that's in, you know, Siberia and South America and, you know, Northern America too. But what about Europe? And all I could really find were some books on Celtic shamanism. For some reason, the Celtic tradition seems to have embraced this kind of meditative work more strongly than the Germanic side of paganism has. So I had some very powerful experiences early on in my practice along those lines. But I actually know very few heathens who engage in that kind of practice, in that kind of strong, deep meditative practice, or even, God forbid, you know, the consumption of things like Liberty Cap magic mushrooms or other things, which, you know, I do believe that our ancestors did engage in. So there is that more esoteric side of things, that kind of inner circle side of things, which I do think is a bit neglected in most Germanic heathen circles. And I would go so far as to say that that is probably because among the more folkish heathen groups, lots of people come to that from a more political point of origin. They come to it from politics. So the communal aspect of it is what appeals to them most, because they want a place to get together with like-minded people of a similar ethnic background or whatever. But a few of them actually merge that with any form of individual practice. And am I right in saying that that's what your books are? Again, these are books which I've had recommended to me by people I very much trust and admire, your books on the Black Sun and the Armanan runes. I haven't yet had a chance to read any. I do actually have the first one on its way to me currently, along with the Elder Trow. But your books on the Black Sun and the Armanan runes, are they more about individual personal practice? And would you mind giving just a very brief introduction to the subject matter of those books?
Yeah, it is an attempt to address this very issue. The question is, what have we done in the development of modern heathenry to address this? Now, of course, there's no universal standard in modern heathenry, so some groups will have done more than others in this regard. But I think that the lack of this, or what I have seen as a lack of this, has led a number of modern heathens to look to other traditions to fill these gaps. More these days than in the past, you will hear heathens talking about an interest in Vedic traditions or culture or Zoroastrianism or some other tradition that they're drawing on, they're looking to try to fill that gap. It's not necessarily a gap in heathenry in general, because I'm sure that in ancient times, the heathens had something to address this. The issue, to my mind, is that it's in modern heathenry that we haven't been able to fully recover that, of course, because there's no unbroken chain of transmission. We don't have access to whatever our ancestors' ancient spiritual practices would have been. I mean, we have some information, but we don't have enough to really thoroughly reconstruct that. But there has been some work that was done in that regard, and it wasn't since the 1970s in modern heathenry. I'm talking about earlier than that. There were some German writers who previously had done some work in that regard and developed a whole world of spiritual practices that can be undertaken by the individual and which are focused on the runes. So they are, you know, it's a very Germanic attempt at developing a spirituality, and the attempt that they made does have some indications that there may have been something like that in ancient times as well. It's not just all a modern invention. And about the Armon and Rune practices is that they tend to be very effective. A lot of the people who have made use of them will report that. They will say, this is doing something for me. This is helping me. This is changing me. This is making me, or giving me the tools that I need to help myself to become a better person and to fulfill some of those needs that you might not just be getting out of the way modern heathenry is generally done. So I've looked at those practices and those traditions and tried to present this in my books in a way that will offer the modern heathen something more to work with in that regard, to try to accomplish this goal of working on the inner transformation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the Armon and runes are something which I must admit I'm not particularly knowledgeable on. My understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, Alfric, is that Guido von List, he based the meanings of the runes on the stanzas from Havamal. So he associated each of the runes with one of the what he believed to be relevant stanzas from the Havamal, right?
That's correct. Yes, yeah. The Havamal rune poem has 18 stanzas in it. So the first 16, even scholars will agree that these correspond to the younger Futhark. And the 16 rune younger Futhark is the essence of the Armon and Futhark, with two additional runes added. The Armon and Futhark has two more runes. Both of those come from the elder Futhark. And the forms of the runes in the Armon and Futhark are all attested forms in ancient times. So some people like to say that the Armon and Futhark is a modern invention. I've made an argument in my book that that is really not the case. It's really the younger Futhark in the context of the Havamal poem. And we have a number of other indications in the Edda that there may have been an 18 rune row, even though it wasn't used on the surviving standing stones in Scandinavia. There's definitely indications that it's some form of authentic rune row that von List was rediscovering.
Yeah, and it's the way I see it, it's all just a form of sincere exploration, right? So even if it so happens that, you know, the 17th and 18th runes of Guido von List are not accurate, or even if some of the other runes he's maybe wrongly assigned to the stanzas, and you might read his work and think, right, okay, well, I think he's got that wrong, that one wrong, and that one wrong. The point is that he made an effort to try and push forward our understanding of both the Havamal, the runes, and our traditions overall by finding these connections in seeking them. So I can never really understand people who have a problem with people who are sincerely trying to find those connections. If we can identify that somebody is being insincere in their intent, in their approach to these things, then I can understand some criticism coming in there. But mistakes are, you know, are always going to be a part of human nature. We're always going to make mistakes. And, you know, someone else might pick up on, you know, someone like yourself might pick up on von List's work and say, okay, well, I'm pretty sure he got that wrong. I'm going to correct that, but take everything he did get right and help move us in a positive direction. And what you've given people there, what he's given people and what you've given people through your work based on his is tools. And it's my belief that especially when you're working on yourself, on your own psychology, your own spirituality, all you really need is some form of tool. And it almost doesn't matter what the tool is. It's like, you know, I can, if I've got some digging to do, if I've got to dig some turf in my paddock, I can pick up a shovel or I can pick up a fork, and the fork will do a pretty good job of digging that turf up as well. The point is that there is some kind of tool at our disposal, which at least enables us to start on that work. And that's kind of how I see the Armanum runes.
I see them that way as well. And that's a very good point that you're making, because I think that it's quite common in religions all over the world to say, here is our standard. You have to be like this or be like that. And just do it, right? They're not necessarily always going to tell you how to do it or give you a sufficient toolbox to be able to do it. What if you say, I can't do it? For some reason, I don't have the ability to live up to this standard. But then they say, okay, well, we'll condemn you now, right? Wouldn't it be better if we had a toolbox, if we could say, okay, here are the standards of our community, whatever that community may be, and here's some tools that we have experimented with ourselves so we know that they work, that you can use as well, that will help you in whatever ways you need to be helped in order to be the person that you want to be and to be able to meet those standards.
Yeah, very much so. So do you think that are you someone who thinks that there is a place for UPG, for unverified personal gnosis?
Well, that's a very good question as well, because I think UPG comes into play a lot of the time in religion in general and certainly in heathenry. What do you designate as UPG? In Theodism, for example, the founding of Theodism was when Garmin Lord had this experience where he met Woden. Right. And some people might call that UPG. It's the central aspect to the founding of Theodish belief. So we see it here. We see it there. Almost everybody has some sort of UPG that is connecting them, making them feel connected to religion, to heathenry, to the gods. It's a reflection of a personal experience. You're having some kind of a personal experience that makes you feel that this is where you belong and this is what you need to do. But the alternative to UPG, what is it? Is it a strict academic scholarship, right? If something can't be proven by scholarship and accepted by academics, then you're not going to believe it at all. Well, there's some people that think that. That's okay if you want to think that. But I think that if your definition is that scientific, of what you will accept as real or not real, then you may end up having a hard time applying that to religion, which is something that goes beyond science, which goes beyond minute historical facts, and like we said before. So there's a disconnect between the world of academia and religion. Now, of course, we depend on academics and scholars to a large extent to know anything about our ancient heathenry at all or what to do with it to try to practice it today. So that's an important aspect. But I think that we need to go beyond that and realize there is going to be a religious and spiritual development that at some point it's going to have to leave the strictly academic world and go into that other realm that is more strictly religious or spiritual.
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to our earlier discussion on narratives and who forms them. Because if you're going to insist on allowing academia to inform what is UPG and what is not, and therefore what is valid and what is not, it could well be that the academics or the wider academic community that you're kind of looking to are not actually telling the story of your folk or telling it with sincerity or for the right reasons. So then you have heathens will say, okay, well, I'm not paying any attention to the academics. What I am interested in is what the source material says. So they'll look to the Eddas, to the poetic and the prose, and they'll look to the sagas, and they'll look to the old Anglo-Saxon poems and the riddles, and you know, all of the source material we have from the oldest point in time, closer to a pre-Christian past. And they'll say, okay, well, if it's not attested there in those sources, then it's UPG, and therefore I'm going to reject it. My approach to that is that yes, to a large extent, I think that's a valid way to look at things. But I do instinctively feel that there are certain concepts among our heathen ancestors which were so presumed, innate within them that they may not have even been written down at all, or certainly not with any accuracy. So, you know, I can't think of any great examples right at this moment, but, you know, perhaps something like meditative practice. That's something which is written about occasionally here and there in the ancient lore, but not very much. And I think that, I'm fairly certain that our ancient ancestors, it was a universal regular practice for them to go under the hood, to visit the, you know, the spirit world, to visit one of the other realms. So I do think that there is room for us to find certain truths which are perfectly in keeping with our ancestral ways, but may not have been explicitly written about in the source material. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's really a question of balance. I've spent a huge amount of time looking through ancient sources, trying to discover everything I can about ancient heathen religious practices, with the purpose not just to know about it, but to put these into practice. So yes, that is a very, very important aspect of what we're trying to do here. But you can get caught up completely in that and say, this is all we're doing. We're drawing the line here. If it wasn't in the sources, then we're not going to do it. And then you have the opposite side of that, where people may not pay much attention to the sources at all, and they may go in a totally UPG direction. This is what I feel from my experience. And then it is what they come up with as a heathen practice is not grounded in the sources, right? Mm. It's just all out there in UPG land. But I think that it's really the ideal thing would be to have a balance between the two. You're rooted and grounded in the sources, in what we actually know of the ancient heathenry, but at the same time, you're not afraid to go beyond that into less certain realms of, you know, spirituality, because in order for it to be a living tradition, we need to go beyond the sources. Yes. We can't just say, okay, it cuts off at this point in history and then that's it, and there's nothing else to our heathenry after that. If this is a living, growing, organic tribal religion, then we are going to have to add our experiences to it so that it will grow and change and become something over time and work within all of the realms of the human need and experience, much of which is something that you could too easily write off as UPG.
Mm. Yeah. Again, it comes down to balance, doesn't it? You know, we keep coming back to that. It seems to be the kind of theme of this conversation so far, is the idea of finding balance between healthy aspects of heathenry, both of which benefit our overall communal and individual growth.
Yeah. Yeah. Balance is so important in everything in life.
Yeah. Yeah. I do have a question which I'd like to pose to you, and I don't know if this is something that you're interested in discussing or not, but I've been looking for someone to discuss it with actually for a while, because I've had a couple of people I think who are newer to heathenry who've said to me, you know, what's the heathen take on this? What do more experienced heathens think about this? And before I reveal what the question is, I think it's true. I think it's a subject which I've personally never seen discussed. And I'm sure there are books out there that have tried to tackle it in some way, but I've never come across them myself. So I'm interested in your take on this. how do we as heathens reconcile our beliefs, our origins as mankind, as being forged by the gods, with the theory of evolution? So if this is something you're not interested in commenting on, then please feel free to say, but otherwise, you know, you're an experienced heathen who's obviously not afraid to explore, you know, to the farthest reaches of our ancestral lore. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
I do, and I'd be happy to discuss that. The theory of evolution is something that interested me a lot in my earlier days of heathenry, for probably the same reasons as the people who are asking you about it now. I was wondering, how can I square this with my belief in our creation myth and such? There seems to be a major incongruity there. I studied the theory of evolution in university. I had the same questions as the people that are asking this of you. And I got to study this in an academic setting, and I studied it in close detail because I was trying to answer these questions. So what I found in my study of the theory of evolution is that it is held together by assumptions. There's a couple of places, and so they'll present a body of evidence that is part of the theory, because it's a fairly complicated theory. And then they will say, assuming that this, mm-hmm. then this. They will link that section of the theory to another section of the theory, and then you'll find another assumption that will link that section to yet another section. So if a theory is linked together with assumptions which are not proven, then how can you say that the theory is proven?
Yeah, absolutely.
So my idea is that I don't think that the theory of evolution is satisfactorily proven to be something that I can wholeheartedly believe in. There are parts of it that are certainly correct. And when it comes to microevolution, it's absolutely proven that that happens. But macroevolution, that one species can completely transform into another, the proof just isn't there, in my opinion. So I don't worry about how to reconcile it with my heathen beliefs, because to me, the theory of evolution is one of many things that comes from science that will have turned into a belief system. And this is a problem, because science is not a religion. Science is a methodology. It's a methodology that is very useful and helpful for doing certain things, and in other areas it isn't so helpful. And one of the ways it's not helpful is when people believe in science as if it was a religion. There are certain things that are scientifically proven that you can believe in, yes, and that help us greatly. I'm not trying to discount that. But science is no substitute for religion. So I'm not looking for ways to reconcile science and religion. I'm content with my greater poetic significance understanding of our creation that is told in our lore. That right. is satisfying to me. I feel no need to reconcile it with the theory of evolution.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a pretty kind of mature and sound way of looking at it, just to say I'm not going to try and change the minds of people who believe in the theory of evolution, but I have looked at this, and I've looked at it in accordance with my ancestral tradition, and I'm sticking with that. I think, yeah, I can't fault that at all. And just to offer a brief anecdote here to your mention of science. Today I was looking at, the new house I have that I moved into 6 months ago, we have a kind of dilapidated coach house, and it's hundreds of years old, and it needs renovating at some point. And I was looking at the ceiling underneath between the beams, and discovered that it's asbestos. And I'm assuming that you have this same issue with asbestos in Canada as we
yes,
do here.
We do.
Well, so, and I was just thinking, well, at one point in time, you know, many decades ago, asbestos was assumed by scientists to be perfectly safe and suitable for people to have within their homes. And then several decades later, it was discovered that actually it's extremely harmful to human health. We've had a similar thing on a bigger scale, really, over the last 3 years, really. And this is something we may get into a little bit later in the conversation, possibly, with the idea of these mRNA vaccines that have been offered to people. Some in many instances in quite a forceful manner. And you'll have people who will say, trust the science. You think, well, okay, trust the science at which point in time? Because at one point in time, there are various things which were agreed to be healthy, which are no longer deemed to be healthy. Nicotine and, that's a whole other debate. But there are certain things which at one point scientists said were absolutely fine for human consumption or habitats. And they now agree that they're not. So, you know, people need to stop treating science as something which is fixed in time. It's not. It's something which is changing, as you alluded to. It's a process. It's a useful tool. It's not a final belief system in itself. On the subject of the theory of evolution, just for those who are wondering what I'm even kind of wondering about, who are maybe newer to heathenry and don't understand why there would even be any conflict between the heathen and the so-called scientific official view on evolution. In the heathen worldview, we believe that the gods literally granted us spirit, that they granted us holiness, that they essentially granted us life. So if you believe that mankind came from, that we evolved from apes, then, I'm only interested in asking questions about this stuff. I'm not saying that something is right one way or the other. I just think that there are questions which need to be asked. And I think heathens need to be more bold in tackling this. You know, if it's the case that we evolved from apes, then does that mean that the gods were always there throughout those tens, hundreds of thousands of years where we were, you know, pre-human? Were they there in their current form? Obviously they had no form physically, but were they there in the way that they exist for that tens or hundreds of thousands of years, waiting for us to reach a certain point in evolution when they then granted us that spirit that is befitting of mankind? Were they the ones that catalyzed that moment of evolution? Did the gods only come into existence just prior to that moment of evolution? You see how there is and I'm speaking to the listeners here, not you, Alfred, but you see how there is a somewhat of a difficult conflict there between the two views. And it seems to me that most heathens they explain all of this away by saying that the heathen view is symbolic, that it's metaphorical, that when in the Eddas it says that the gods granted us Ond, Odin granted us Ond, then that is symbolic or representative of evolution itself or something like that. So I don't know if you have any further comments on that, Alfred.
Well, when we take that view of it, that the creation as told in our lore is symbolic, then what we're really saying is that what we really believe in is a literal truth. A literal historical fact is the only thing that we're willing to say has some kind of a truth to it, rather than something of greater significance, a greater understanding. And I think that this is where we really need to look at what we believe. Our modern dependence on academic studies and on trying to see a historical fact has given us a really scientistic worldview. That's again where you take science to be a belief system, and only the thing which can be scientifically proven is something that I'm willing to believe in, right? So that's what I'm saying, is that truth goes beyond that. Truth is something that exists in higher realms, that transcends time and place, and it's this the opposite of having a scientistic worldview, where your religion is science, is a mystified worldview. In ancient times, the elder heathen, they had a mystified worldview. So what we're really trying to do to a large extent in heathenry, and especially as shops or storytellers, is to work on somewhat challenging the scientific worldview, you know, drawing attention to what science really is.
And restoring some mystery.
Yeah, and restoring the mystified worldview so that we can start seeing beyond it, that we don't need to just look at, you know, believing only in something that is scientifically proven, when belief by nature is something that goes so far beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it, in a way that kind of sums up the blight of our modern, I say our, I'm not referring to Alfred and I, but collectively as a species, we have this very materialist, atheist view, which accepts science as being the dominant truth or fact of existence. And really what we've done there by accepting that is to try to remove the mystification, as Alfred says, of our reality, of our history, of our origins, of our gods and our ancestors and our afterlife destination. All of that, we've just tried to remove all possible doubt from the equation. When actually, in the spirit of, the famous heathen phrase, re interruna, you know, seek the mysteries, actually we should be embracing the fact that we have these mysteries to live amongst and to actually enjoy. You know, in some ways, a mystified world is a far more compelling, magical, and enjoyable world to live in.
Absolutely. And the mystified world, the mystified worldview, is the heathen worldview. If you have a worldview that is only scientific and you can't believe in anything that isn't some scientifically or historically proven fact taken literally, then there's a whole aspect of heathenry that you're not going to be able to experience. You're not going to be able to read omens. You're not going to be able to have any a deeper sense of connection with land spirits, right? Mm-hmm. You won't be able to see them. They could be right in front of you, but you won't be able to have any experience or interaction with them because your scientific mind will be writing them off as this or that. You know, that's what we do. We come up with an explanation. Oh, it was just some light, or it was just the wind, or when we encounter something that we aren't sure what it is, the first thing we do is we try to find a scientific explanation for it. Well, when you write everything off like that in your experience, what is there left in heathenry that you can really authentically experience? There has to be some change of worldview to even acknowledge or accept these things that we encounter in heathenry as real.
It's such an important point. It really is, because when I spoke to Thorbecht in the Thirdish Belief episode, I was very pleasantly surprised. You know, and I've read on Thirdish Belief. I've read some of the works of Swain Wodening in the past, and one of Thorbecht's books as well. So I'm familiar with the Thirdish worldview, but I was surprised to find in speaking with Thorbecht how superstitious Thirdsmen are. And that's a really wonderful thing, because as Alfred just alluded to there, you know, if we explain every sign and symbol and flight of a bird or, gust of wind and play of light, if we explain all of that away as just happenstance, coincidence, or try to find some kind of mundane explanation for it, then we're actually missing out on a wealth of assistance from the whites and the gods, and a relationship with them. And you mentioned earlier about Garmon Lord's experience meeting Woden. I actually met Woden myself. I had this a similar experience. I'm not actually familiar with the details of Garmon Lord's experience. Garmon Lord, for anyone wondering, by the way, is the founder of Thirdish belief in the 70s, I believe, in America. I met Woden too, and yes, my first reaction was to try and explain it away somehow, scientifically or in a mundane manner. I spent weeks trying to explain it away until I just came to the conclusion that even with my very empirical, materialist upbringing, I couldn't explain it. It only made sense that it was a visitation from Walden. And that incident, that single incident, along with a couple of others, but that one most importantly, put me on the path that I'm on today. I wouldn't be having this conversation with Alfred. The Fergan podcast wouldn't exist. All of the conversations that hopefully the listeners have enjoyed wouldn't have happened. I wouldn't be working as I do towards the promotion of our ancestral belief in the way that I do. And that's because I embraced that mystical experience and accepted it for what it was, rather than trying to dismiss it as something scientific.
Yeah, that sounds like a very interesting experience you had. And I think it's a great illustration for the point that I was making.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the warm-up conversation that Alfred and I had, Alfred, you made a really good point, I thought, about this idea that we must be careful as heathens not to automatically reject a concept purely because it happens to be similar to one that is within the Abrahamic faith, so Christianity, or even Islam or Judaism, or a concept that happens to be shared with another culture or something like that. I thought that was a really good point that you made there, because as you mentioned, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but it does seem like a lot of heathens do tend to define themselves by an opposition to Christianity, right?
Yeah, that's related to what we've been talking about here. In the early days of science, you had this opposition taking place between science and Christianity. Science was rejecting the original ideas of the church and saying, no, we're going to look at this a new way and understand things differently. And this was a horrendous battle between the two for many centuries that, to some extent, certainly still goes on today. So with science and Christianity having a natural opposition, there's certainly a tendency for modern heathens to identify with science because heathenry is also opposed to Christianity. But one of the problems with that, like we were discussing before, is that what if there are some similarities? And there are some similarities. If we're going to be completely honest, there are some things about Christianity and heathenry that are similar. And it would be very easy for us to throw out discard something that was an actual valid element of the ancient heathenry just because it looks a little bit too much like something that's in Christianity. We're so busy as heathens, as modern heathens, trying to define ourselves in opposition to Christianity that we could easily miss out on things that were actually an important part of our own ancient heathen tradition.
Yeah. I like the fact that you brought up Christianity versus science, or atheism or secularism, because it's a struggle. It's a political struggle almost, isn't it? When you've got these two competing factions, you've got the church and you've got the challengers to the church or whatever. You've maybe got different factions of power within a nation state, one who has chosen to try and uphold the values of the church and one who is trying to maybe dismantle them in the favor of some kind of enlightenment worldview. And then in modern times, that's kind of been replaced by paganism, or mostly heathenry opposing the kind of core tenets of Christianity, because there's this near almost political struggle between the two groups, the two factions almost. And I think it is very important for us to try not to fall into that trap, because not only can we miss out on some important truths and wisdoms there, we can also betray the overall narrative of our folk by doing that. And we spoke about how important it is to uphold that folk narrative, that worldview that we share with our living and deceased folk. And it also makes us easy to manipulate, because those in power, in whether in the media or whatever, they're able to play off groups against one another in this way by saying, you know, by carefully suggesting to one group, well, your opponent believes this, so you can't possibly do that, and, you know, vice versa. So it does open us up to manipulation.
It does. And it's a very political struggle between the two groups, you know, whether that was science and Christianity or heathenry and Christianity. So, I think the important thing is that we try to discover what heathenry really is. It's not always just what is opposite to Christianity. We don't always have to define ourselves in opposition to something else.
Mm-hmm.
We can pay less attention to that and just focus on what is heathenry really, just taking heathenry on its own, more on its own terms rather than in opposition to something.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when we position ourselves in, you know, polar direct opposition to an existing narrative, we're actually, ironically, upholding that narrative rather than pursuing our own narrative. And I used in a recent Telegram post, I used the example of the rainbow, the symbol of the rainbow. You know, the rainbow in modern times is used among certain groups for political purposes to promote a certain agenda. Within the Abrahamic tradition, the rainbow is a symbol of Noah's covenant with Yahweh. And both of those things are outside of the Northern European narrative, right? But we shouldn't reject the positive symbol of a rainbow because of that. The symbol is associated with our gods, with our spirituality, and with our relationship with the natural world. We need to embrace it and not be afraid to do so purely because it's being used for political purposes or it's being used for different purposes within the Abrahamic narrative. So yeah, we do need to be careful, and you know, those who are interested a bit more in this idea, check out a video I made a while back called The Victim-Perpetrator Bond, which talks about this, how by automatically positioning ourselves as opposed to something, we are actually upholding that thing. If we're focused on opposing something, then we are focusing on that thing which we are opposing, and we're giving it our energy, we are validating it, perhaps most importantly, we are not putting that energy into forging our own narrative or upholding our own narrative.
Yeah, I entirely agree with everything that you've said. When we focus on our opponents, we give them a huge amount of energy, and we also allow them to consume us in the process. And we've seen a lot of that, especially in the last 3 years, where you have two sides of the thing, each side is basically being consumed by their hatred of the perspective of the other side. So, this is the power of narratives. And it goes back to the question of who is writing the narratives that we are all consuming. And then that goes back and ties into our work, because we need to go beyond these narratives that are being forced on us from both sides and start rewriting these narratives for ourselves and for our folk, so that we can have our lives can be informed by a narrative that is positive and empowering to us rather than something that is causing us harm.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the way that this the conversation is flowing here, because this leads perfectly to the next part of it, which I wanted to introduce, which is you're not a huge fan of social media, right? you told me in the warm-up conversation that you've kind of actively taken yourself out of social media and you don't really pay attention to politics. Am I right there?
I would. I have to pay attention to politics to a certain extent, just for the sake of staying informed. But I make an effort to not let it consume me the way it seems to consume a lot of modern people, and the way it used to consume me a lot more, I have to say. And that's one of the reasons why I stopped using social media, because you have social media being used to reinforce one narrative and another narrative, and it's a constant battle. When I was on social media, I found that I was being exposed constantly to one narrative or another, or both actually, on a regular basis. And that has a tendency to consume your thought. You know, it's taking up your time, first of all, to be on there. It's time you're spending there instead of having experiences in the real world. And it's consuming your thought. You're not only thinking about it when you're being exposed to it, actually being on social media, it goes with you. You go about your day, and these thoughts, these concerns of all these things that everybody has said from these narratives, you take it with you, and it becomes all consuming. It's a way for the narrative to take over your life and take over your thought. Whereas I think that it's better if I'm thinking my own thoughts, if I'm working within my own narrative, rather than constantly being inundated with something that is basically being imposed on me from other people.
Yeah, it's almost a form of pollution, really, isn't it? And you know, we a lot of people pay close attention to what we put into our bodies, you know, whatever liquid, alcohol, whatever we consume food-wise as well. A lot of people pay attention to living a healthy lifestyle and avoiding toxins and things. But we perhaps don't consider the fact that there are such things as kind of almost ideological toxins or psychological toxins. And I think those do come in the forms of these pointless, petty political debates that we have. And you know, I'm kind of following a similar path to you at the moment, really, where I'm realizing that there really is very little to be gained from discussing what people call the current thing, the current events that are being served up to us by the mainstream media, and whether we are in favor of them or as dissidents opposed to them and saying this is an outrage. Can you believe that they're doing this? We're still allowing those things to pollute our space, our psychological space, our spiritual space. And there is so much, there's such a more wholesome way of life in pursuing those things which are unrelated to what's being served up to you, from pursuing things from your own point of view, from forging our own narrative. And you know, I've definitely and you know, my conversation with Thorbecht has definitely empowered me to dedicate more of my energy towards my religious spiritual pursuits, and you know, that's one of the reasons that this conversation is happening now. And I just realized that what we really need to be doing is those things which make us feel empowered. Paying attention to politics, the mainstream media, that actually just makes us feel disempowered, because we realize that we're being outraged by things that we have no control over. Whereas within our own lives, we do have you know, a much larger amount of control. If we have families, we have influence over our families, over our children. If we're homesteading, and that's something we'll get to in a minute, we have an influence over our supply of food and, you know, our ability to survive in a somewhat independent fashion. But one thing I do wonder with this, and I wanted to ask you, is that, you know, you're a renowned musician and author. It must be difficult promoting your works, your musical works, your authored books, without a strong social media presence.
It does make it more difficult. It's true. And I've noticed since I stopped using social media, I've noticed that there have been some changes in that regard. Nevertheless, I'm not particularly concerned about it. I think that when you have your materials out there and they're distributed, they have a tendency to sort of promote themselves, especially if you've been around for a while. And also, while I do want to reach as many people as I'm able to, my goal with none of this was ever to make money. So I'm not going out of my way to, you know, to treat it like a business where I'm trying to rake in as much cash as I can, so that I'm super worried about having a little bit less exposure to people who know me directly from not having social media. And the payoff of not having social media, the peace of mind, the freedom of thought that I have to determine my own narrative, and the pollution-free environment that creates in my life is more than worth anything that I might lose in promotion from not having social media.
Yeah, you do strike me, you know, in the short interactions that we've had, you do strike me as someone who is rather unpolluted. You know, you seem to have the mindset of a man who knows his world, he knows his theod, his home, his homestead, his ideas, his worldview, his ancestral faith, and you're pursuing that in a healthy manner rather than being bogged down with other things. I think that's something that many of us could aspire to. And I do think that, especially when you're working in these more kind of, not going to say esoteric, but let's say alternative circles, that when you're putting more alternative ideas, information, even heathenry, as much as it is an ancestral religion, at the moment, it is still fairly fringe and fairly niche. But the people who are looking for information on that, or looking for music which speaks to that, which is connected to it in the way that your music is and my music is, I feel that those people who are well and truly seeking those things, they will find it, no matter how widely it's promoted and marketed or not. People who really want to seek something, they will find it eventually.
That's absolutely true. And I've noticed that as well. People will simply continue to find what they're looking for. And I also think that there are other ways that we can reach people. It doesn't always have to be through social media. And the Fyrgian is a perfect example of that. The medium that you're using here to get information and ideas out to people, we could look to more of this type of thing in the future. For you know, the many, many people who are frustrated with social media, you know, we don't have to work within those confines. We don't have to believe that narrative that tells us that we depend on social media. We can start doing other things. We have the ability to do that. And I foresee a day when one day social media might not be so popular anymore.
Yeah.
Or at least we can hope.
Yeah, I hope so too, and I hope that comes about because people start to move close to one another geographically, or just limit their kind of channels of communication to more secure, more personable, more healthy channels. You know, perhaps things like even just returning to the good old fashioned telephone. Or, you know, I still enjoy just sharing emails with people rather than it needing to be this kind of fast-paced messaging app experience where the conversations seem to be forgotten a week later. But yeah, and again, this moves on nicely to our last topic that I wanted to discuss in however much detail you'd like to, Alfred, but you are, Thorbecht informed me that you are an avid homesteader. You live out there in rural British Columbia in Canada. You have what looks to be a beautiful home, from what I can see in the webcam image here. So would you mind kind of talking about, I mean, well, I'll go first and I'll say that, you know, I'm doing something similar. I'm not sure where I am in relation to where you are in terms of how advanced we are in homesteading. I'm at a fairly early stage of it, but it's something that my wife and I were aiming to do 10, 15 years ago. But we were just slowly working towards building up enough money and things like this, and somehow finding a way eventually to do it. There was no real sense of urgency. But when 2020 hit and the so-called lockdowns, you know, a prison term there, were imposed on much of the world, not just the Western world, but the world as a whole, we realized that big change was here. Freedom of association, freedom of movement, freedom of transaction, you know, just in terms of being able to buy food, the food that you want freely, using currency that you want to use without having to jump through certain hoops to get there. We realized that all of this was coming to an end, and this is provably so. With increasing velocity. So this is why we upped the ante in terms of finding some rural land where we could live a more independent lifestyle. So what was your sort of journey to this? How long ago did it begin? And how have you been getting on with it?
Homesteading is something that I've wanted to do for a long time. It's sort of been a long-term goal for my whole adult life. But of course, when you're younger, there are some things that will stand in the way of that may resolve the older you get. For me, it was in 2018 when I could see the writing on the wall. I was looking at the way things were going in the world and economically, and my wife and I, we just said to each other, you know, we better do something about this. We better get into a place where we could be more independent if we should have to be. And we were right, of course, because then you could see things changing a couple years after that. So we were happy to be able to get to this place here in the middle of nowhere and get started on really trying to become more independent in terms of our food production, as well as a number of other things. But food being a big concern, there's all kinds of reasons right now, as I'm sure you're aware, to be concerned about the availability of food supply and such. So what we've tried to do, what we've been working on for the last 5 years here, is to get ourselves into a position where if we had to, we would be able to provide all of our own food. And I would say that we're not quite there yet, but we're close. It's something that you have to work towards over years to develop, is what we found. You can't just, you know, go to a place and then, you know, say, okay, we're going to plant all this stuff and then next year we'll have all the food we need. No. It's something that you have to develop over time. So we've been working on that. And now, particularly with my grain crops, after doing 3 years of it, I can say that if I had to, yes, I now have the ability to grow enough grain to feed our family for a year. If that was our only source of grain, we would still have bread all year.
That's wonderful. And you're right. I mean, it's not just right. Okay, we've got the land now, and we've got the seeds. Cultivating, you know, vegetable beds takes time. It takes time to even transform the soil. It takes time to build up a store of compost, you know, healthy compost, so that you can, because you're not self-sufficient unless you have a continuous supply of compost. So yeah, it does take time. And, you know, when you're speaking for myself, I still have to work a day job. I'm still working, you know, a full working week and quite a long one at that. So really it's my time homesteading is confined to weekends. My wife is able to spend a bit more time, but you know, we're homeschooling the children. So there are all kinds of things that get in the way of it. And the other big barrier I found, and I don't know if it's the same where you are, Alfred, but it's the cost of materials, particularly timber. Here, I mean, the cost of timber, I mean, you may be able to you know, mill your own timber where you are. I imagine that's quite common in Canada, but where I am, the cost of timber has been pretty extortionate. And that's been a real barrier, because, you know, even just edging vegetable beds or building a chicken coop or, you know, refencing an area can be really expensive now.
Oh, I'm sure it can. And I'm sorry to hear that it's that way over there. I'm not surprised that it is. We're better off in that regard here. We've got lots of trees. And yes, I do have a mill and I make my own lumber at practically no cost. So at least that's one thing that we don't have to be concerned about here. But then again, we're also using a lot of modern machines in the things that we're doing. So what happens when you can't get gas or diesel, or you need parts and you can't get parts? You know, even when you're working independently, there is a concern about being able to continue, at least in the way that we are right now, because we are still dependent on the modern world for so many things.
Yeah. It's a good point. I mean, at what point can you ever call yourself truly self-sufficient? I mean, you, even if you're growing all of your own food, you know, you have enough livestock to feed your family. If you're only able to maintain that because of modern machinery and, you know, gas that you have to buy in from stores which import it from elsewhere and things like that, then you're still dependent on some kind of supply chain. But I think this is one of the things a lot of people will say to me, but particularly young men who want to work towards this kind of lifestyle that that you and I have worked towards, Alfred. And they'll say that they'll talk about how impossible it seems, how they'll never be able to do it. But I always try and let them know that it's a matter of degrees. It's not a binary thing. You are not 100% dependent, 100% self-sufficient. You are somewhere on the scale between those things. And even, you know, 0.5% towards self-sufficiency is a step in the right direction. You know, even if you've just got some grow bags on a patio that you're growing some potatoes in, that is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, it is. And I remember being a lot younger and feeling like it was impossible too, you know. But those obstacles are overcome with time, especially if you make good decisions, or you make your best effort to make good decisions. And if you want something badly enough, eventually you will find a way to get it, to make it happen. So yes, everyone is in a stage. Anyone who's trying to do this is somewhere along the lines. And, you know, eventually you could drop your dependency on machinery and start using really old fashioned stuff, you know, like plowing with horses and things like that. But I guess it's a question of where you draw the line and how difficult is it and how much do you need to do that? You know, I haven't felt like I've needed to pursue plowing with horses, but I tell you, if I couldn't get parts or fuel, then I would be looking at that pretty quickly. And there's lots of horses around here, so I'd probably find a way to get sorted out with horses fairly quickly.
It's a large part of it is psychological. It's about being open to the challenge. You know, as you point out there, it's about having the attitude of, okay, well, if that avenue closes, then I'll try this. I may not have any education in it. I may have no experience, but if I need to do it, I'll have a go at it, and you know, we'll see what happens. It kind of ties into what we were saying earlier about just seeing the wonder in things and embracing the uncertainty of things, and saying, okay, well, that's going to be a challenge, but I'm going to embrace that challenge. I'm going to see it as a positive. I'm going to welcome it with arms wide open, rather than, you know, running scared from it.
Absolutely, there is nothing in the world that will limit you as much as your own thoughts.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why we have to be very mindful of our thoughts. We have to be, if we have negative or disempowering thoughts, we need to become aware of that and find some way to do something about it. Because if you can keep yourself in a state of thinking good and positive thoughts and staying open-minded and not limiting yourself, then you'd be surprised how much is actually possible. It's when we say things like, oh, I could never do that, or I would never have the ability to, you know, this is out of reach because of this and this and this and this. Well, you can see all of those obstacles fold so quickly, right? And then you realize the barrier was only in your mind.
Yeah.
Right? You may have to wait some time. We can't always have everything instantly, but that just goes back to the idea about the pollution of thoughts that we were talking about earlier, whether that comes from social media or narratives that are being handed down to us. That's why it's so important for us to establish our own narratives that are empowering, so that we can really do what we want to do in life and be successful and healthy and happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't have put that better. And also, I think this is where heathenry comes in. You know, when I spoke with Thorbecht, he talked about the luck of the tribe, how much of the work of Fairdish belief is based on increasing the luck of the community of the Faird, and doing this through the Fairdish ritual work. And you know, I did a podcast with Anders Nilsson, and I think one of the most important things I took from that conversation was this idea of Mayen. And I hope I'm pronouncing that right, because my good friend Huitjard mentioned to me that when I spoke of that word in conversation with Anders Nilsson, and I was pronouncing it as Magen, I was mispronouncing it, because in Old English, as I'm sure Alfred knows, the G is silent there, or it's a Y sound. But yeah, this concept of Mayen, of building up one's personal spiritual power. And Anders Nilsson talked about how we do this by making by envisioning ourselves as a source of light. We need to envision the fact that by performing noble acts and acts that are good for the folk, we are becoming brighter, and the gods therefore see us, and the gods therefore favor us. So that's something we can bring in. You know, if you find this whole prospect of facing these modern struggles daunting, and you have heathen leanings, then realize that by performing the rites at the high holy tides, by honoring the gods, by honoring the ancestors, very important there, you are increasing that spiritual potency which gives you the favor of the gods, and that will take you towards a place where you can achieve things that you didn't think that you could achieve.
Absolutely. That was very well said. Yeah, increasing one's luck, increasing Megan. Yeah, that's one of the central things that we're trying to achieve when we worship the gods. It's the way that heathenry can empower us.
Do you see any other connections between your heathen worldview and the homesteading that you're doing? Is the homesteading purely a reaction to political or not socio-political circumstances, and therefore pretty much separate from the heathen worldview? Or do you see a real interconnectedness between the two?
The two are completely connected as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
What I described before for a reason for coming out here and doing this was really the sort of surface level reason. But deeper down, one of the main reasons that I wanted to do this, I wanted to do it anyway. I would have wanted to do this regardless if I had no concern about food supply in the world. My real reason for always wanting to do this is because I felt that if we can live as close as possible to a traditional heathen lifestyle, we have a better chance of understanding what the ancient heathenry was, because this is the type of thing that the ancient heathens were doing. This is how they were living when they were experiencing heathenry in ancient times. So there's a congruity between the lifestyle and our religion, and one could only hope that the one would enhance the other if you were doing both of them together. I think it's easier to understand and relate to heathenry in the context that we are right now out here trying to be independent and homesteading and living in the bush than it would be if we were living in an apartment. And for an example, right now, I'm just watching two ravens that just flew right in front of me. You know, it's it's all connected. And when I'm out there working in the fields, the thoughts that I have, you know, I'm working hard. I'm thinking about my ancestors who would have been doing this exact same thing. I have the same concerns that they do about weather, about animals or other forces that could possibly harm or destroy my crops, right? I'm thinking about all of these things, my practical concerns about my farming. I'm thinking about them in a heathen context, and the two are feeding back off each other constantly, so that I feel like my heathenry is enhancing my ability to do successful farming, and my farming is enhancing my ability to understand and do heathenry. So to me, that's the best lifestyle that I could hope to have.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's a more ancestral way of living, which seems like a very obvious thing to say, but it's a more ancestral way of living. And in the heathen worldview, anything that is more ancestral is more good. It really is quite as simple as that.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And, you know, you do get some nice kind of byproducts from it. Like, for example, where I've moved to, I can see the stars, you know, and in Western Europe, that's no mean feat, you know, particularly in Britain, which is a very, particularly with the English part of Britain, is very heavily overpopulated. But where I am in Wales is very, it's pretty sparsely populated in the context of the British Isles. So I can actually see the stars. I can, on a good night, I can see the Milky Way. And I believe personally that that is the birthright of all men and women and children, to be able to at least see the stars. And I think it's a travesty that most people can't.
I agree. The earth is our inheritance. It is our right. And I agree. I couldn't agree more. This is the experience of the earth and of living naturally on the earth is something that we are humans are entitled to.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, that about does it for our talking points. And it's been a real honor speaking with you, Alfric. I really appreciate you taking the time to be a guest on the Fergan podcast and for sharing your insights, your wisdoms, your thoughts on things. And I think a lot of the listeners are going to have really enjoyed this one. So yeah, I thank you again for joining us.
Well, I very much enjoyed talking to you today, Dan. This has been great to be on the Fergan. And I hope that we will be able to discuss a lot more in times to come.
Yeah, there's plenty to discuss. So I'm sure we'll speak again and maybe we can do another episode sometime in the future.
That sounds great.
I should add as an addendum to this that you can find Alfric's books on lulu.com, lulu.com. If you just search for Alfric Avery, A-E-L-F-R-I-C, Avery, then you'll find his books that are available. And if you're interested in his music, then you need only to go to bandcamp.com. If you go directly to alfric.bandcamp.com, then you'll see all of his harp music releases available there. And I can strongly recommend checking them out. And on that note, the music that you've heard during this podcast episode, other than the intro, which is my own music, at the very beginning, you'll have heard the song Hildebrand Slid by Alfric. And that's from his album Mimir's Mead. I just put a section of that song in there. And then during the course of the conversation, about halfway through, I featured the song Arendal Gelda, or Yelda, I suppose the proper pronunciation would be. And that's from his album Watling Street. So to end this episode, as always, we'll look at the riddle from the Exeter Riddle Book. And last episode, we were on riddle number 28, corresponding with episode number 28. And the answer to that one is most widely accepted to be John Barleycorn or Ale. It seems that that one can pose some confusion for people trying to discern the meaning of it. It does. I mean, it talks about threshing, couching, kilning, mashing, straining, yeasting, you know, so I think, and it's at the end, it says shrewd men must think carefully what this creature is. You know, it's quite an enigmatic one, that one, but yeah, the answer seems to be related to ale, or as I say, John Barleycorn. This episode's riddle is as follows. I saw a strange creature, a bright ship of the air, beautifully adorned, bearing away plunder between her horns, fetching it home from a foray. She was minded to build a bower in her stronghold and construct it with cunning if she could do so. But then a mighty creature appeared over the mountain, whose face is familiar to all dwellers on earth. He seized on his treasure and sent home the wanderer, much against her will. She went westward, harbouring hostility, hastening forth. Dust lifted to heaven, dew fell on the earth, night fled hence, and no man knew thereafter where that strange creature went. Very poetic and evocative, that one, and I have a feeling I know what it may be, but we'll discuss that next time. For now, I bid you all farewell, and I thank you very much for listening to the Fergan podcast.